All right, we're going to just continue to walk through Genesis. And last time we ended off in chapter 28. And remember, we kind of started the whole, just to keep us in context here, we started the whole Jacob saga all the way back in chapter 25 and verse 19. And it starts off, these are the records of the generations of Isaac. And from there, all the way until we get to chapter 36, basically, we're in one section of the book that basically centers around Jacob. And so, as we've seen throughout these are the generations of statements, it focuses more on the ancestors and what became of the person than necessarily the person himself. It's kind of like, this is the outcome, this is the results of, in one sense, Isaac. And so the focus is on Jacob throughout there. And as we saw last week, of course, he tricked his brother and his father into getting the birthright and the blessing. And so certainly his name, Jacob, and just kind of the connection there with this seat is playing in his name. And basically where we left off last week is after he had not only stole his brother's birthright, but then had stole the blessing, his brother was not happy. So his brother was ready to kill him, and so he's ready to leave. And so he's basically fleeing from his brother. And on the way out, basically, you remember God meets him at Bethel. And so that's where he sees this stairway going into heaven and angels ascending and descending on this stairway. And God basically reassures him that even as he's leaving, even at this low point in his life, that God reassures him and says, I'm still going to be with you, and you will return back to this place. And he sets up a pillar, and he makes a vow, and says, you know, I will return here, and I will worship the Lord. So that basically brings us up to chapter 29. So as we said, God blessed him and said, I will be with you, as he's leaving the promised land, and gives him that reassurance. And so Jacob is on his way out. And so we pick up in chapter 29, and we want to cover a lot of ground tonight, and so hopefully we'll just keep the big picture, but we're going to seek to cover a lot of text here. So let's go to Genesis chapter 29, and we'll read and just continue to walk through the text. Then Jacob went on his journey and came to the land of the sons of the east. And he looked and saw a well in the field, and behold, three flocks of sheep were lying there beside it, for from that well they watered the flocks. Now the stone on the mouth of the well was large. When all the flocks were gathered there, they would roll the stone from the mouth of the well and water the sheep and put the stone back in its place in the mouth of the well. And Jacob said to them, My brothers, where are you from? And they said, We are from Haran. And he said to them, Do you know Laban, the son of Nahor? And they said, We know him. And he said to them, Is it well with him? And they said, It is well. And behold, Rachel, his daughter, is coming with the sheep. And he said, Behold, it is still high day. It is not time for the livestock to be gathered. Water the sheep and go, pasture them. But they said, We cannot until all the flocks are gathered, and they roll the stone from the mouth of the well, then we water the sheep. While he was still speaking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess. And it came about, when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban his mother's brother, then Jacob went up and rolled the stone from the mouth of the well, and watered the flock of Laban his mother's brother. Then Jacob kissed Rachel and lifted his voice and wept. And Jacob told Rachel that he was a relative of her father, and that he was Rebekah's son. And she ran and told her father. So it came about when Laban heard the news of Jacob, his sister's son, that he ran to meet him and embraced him and kissed him and brought him to his house. And then he related to Laban all these things. And Laban said to him, Surely you are my bone and my flesh. And he stayed with him a month. Then Laban said to Jacob, Because you are my relative, should you therefore serve me for nothing? Tell me, what shall your wages be? Now Laban had two daughters. The name of the older was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. And Leah's eyes were weak, but Rachel was beautiful of form and face. Now Jacob loved Rachel, and so he said, I will serve you 7 years for your younger daughter Rachel. And Laban said, it is better that I give her to you than I should give her to another man. Stay with me. So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed to him a few days because of his love for her. So we'll stop there and just kind of pause for a moment. So Jacob has left his land, and similar, does this story, as he kind of heads off to the east, does it remind you of anything we've read thus far?
Like Abraham leaving his
home. Yeah, there's maybe some similarities there. What about another story that maybe even has some more parallels? Anyone? Meeting in a well, finding a woman. No. What's that?
It's not important.
You mean Abraham's servant?
Yeah, seems to be pretty similar in the sense that just as Abraham's servant goes to a well to find a wife, you know, Jacob ends up going to a well and finding his wife. But what would maybe we see as maybe some contrast here? Both in the same country, same land, but are there any significant differences there?
There's no servant. This time, the husband is the servant.
Well, what did we do? If you remember back, what did we see about the servant? What was the whole emphasis of that episode? I know it's been a while. We got covered a lot
of
stories.
Totally trusting the Lord.
Exactly. The servant is praying over and over, and he keeps, like, every time God does something, he's just like, he falls down and starts worshiping the Lord and praising and thanking him. Now, I think it's possible that there's a deliberate contrast here with Jacob. There's nothing like that. It certainly, I think, is intended to display God's providence in that he showed up at the right time and bam, God sends the right woman to him. But there's no thanking God. There's no praying to God. I don't know how much I want to draw, you know, how much of that parallel we would look at. But it is certainly, I think, for one, it is emphasizing God's providence, just as in the previous story. But it's just interesting how here Jacob doesn't recognize or praise God for his providence. That, you know, he shows up at the well, and bam, the girl he's looking for, in essence, shows up there. He's like, hey, is my mother's brother, you know, anyone know him? It's like, right at that moment, right, she shows up. And even, doesn't it say, you know, and they said as well, behold, it's like right at that very moment, and behold, Rachel, his daughter, is coming with the sheep. You know, at that very moment. So it certainly is emphasizing God's sovereignty once again. But as we're going to see with Jacob, these Jacob stories, we saw already his deceit, and we're going to continue to see his deceit until finally God gets a hold of him. And so I think throughout this Jacob story, there seems to be an emphasis on God working despite Jacob, not because of him. And it's really emphasizing God's faithfulness to his word, not Jacob's faithfulness to God. But ultimately, as we'll see at the end of the section we come to tonight, Lord willing, God is going to finally humble Jacob to the point where he is praying, he is depending on the Lord, and then finally he will be reconciled to his brother, and the whole story comes to resolution. But in a sense, all these stories about Jacob, about this and that, we're going to see there's just tons of deception, tons of trouble. I mean, we've already had enough family trouble as it is, right? Where he has to leave, and his mother and his father are basically fighting over the two sons, and he gets kicked out. We're going to see, as it goes on, he's going to have turmoil within his own family and all kinds of trouble and problems, you know? And really, it's showing that God is blessing him. God is working through him despite him. And so I think as we continue to walk through this section, I think we'll continue to see that. And so it's possible that even just the description of that parallels Isaac's servant may even be putting in Jacob in a somewhat negative light, which is done throughout this section. But certainly, once again, God sovereignly led him here. And God is the one that's going to bless him despite himself in some senses. And so he ends up there. And it's interesting, too. I don't know how much to make of it, but there's a big emphasis on how big this stone is over the well. And they tell that there's this whole story about it. And basically, there's a bunch of shepherds, and they're like, well, we have to wait till enough shepherds are there, and then all the shepherds together will, like, move this stone. And then Jacob is asking them to do it, and they're basically like, nah, we'll wait. And it seems, and so he just, like, does it himself. And so it seems to be portraying him as kind of a man of, if you will, ambition. He's a strong man that's, like, a kind of a go-getter. He's the one that's going to make it happen. Whether, you know, if it's the birthright, it's like, I got a plan. So I think part of it is just showing Jacob he's the kind of guy that's a take charge, take action kind of a guy. And we'll see that sometimes the lesson would be, well, sometimes you shouldn't be taking things into your own hands. Sometimes you should be waiting on the Lord. And we'll see that come out more clearly as we go along. But certainly that's the first part of this, yeah?
I don't know. The whole ambition thing and stuff like that. It might just be because he saw Rachel and he wanted to impress her, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
So.
No, exactly.
He seems to be kind of love at first sight.
Yeah, that's exactly what's portrayed here. And so, I don't know how far to go with all of this, but one of the commentators was contrasting how Isaac's servant was prayerful and he wanted to look at Rebecca's character, you know, to see if she was a virtuous woman, whereas Jacob is just all by sight and love at first sight and all that kind of stuff. I don't know how much of that parallel we would draw out there, but it is interesting just to notice some of those things. But we'll move on, and I think as the narrative flows on, you'll see the bigger point, which is God's faithfulness and God's keeping his promise, you know, despite someone's faithfulness or their unfaithfulness, God is going to remain faithful. And that's certainly what we see.
I think we should start an online Christian dating service called The Well. Make a lot of money.
Yeah, exactly. But it's funny here because even God's sovereignty in bringing, like, Rachel and bringing... It's going to be interesting as you see how this whole thing plays out, because there's nothing but trouble ahead of Jacob. And so I think we are going to see here... Well, we'll just read and let the story develop. But... watch how it flows. So Jacob falls in love, as you said, Ethan. This is definitely love at first sight. Whether or not that's good or not, if the author's trying to show that as a good thing or not, remains to be seen. But nonetheless, that's what it is.
I don't think he shows it as a bad thing, because I think it seems to be one of the strengths of Jacob's character that he's willing to work these 7 years. And, well, we'll get to that, but it seems to be more of a strength of character than a weakness here.
Well, the working maybe, but that's not necessarily what, you know, I was talking about. Just more like, anyway.
But doesn't it show respect that he had for Laban's?
Yeah, for sure.
You want to say tradition or whatever? I mean, you would think.
Yeah, I think
that
so.
That would get somebody pretty upset, you know?
No, for sure. For sure. And he did respond in that sense. Jacob's just an interesting character within here, because there's the deception, but you kind of have, Laban is just all, like, in one sense, deception. He's just trying to get Jacob, in one sense, throughout the whole story. But Jacob, you see both aspects of it, in a sense. You see his deception, but you also see his righteous character in some aspects. So he's kind of a double-sided character, in the sense that there's some complexity to who he is and how he acts. But certainly you see both aspects of that. You see, well, even in a sense like Abraham, you see his failures and you see his triumphs. Mm-hmm. And so that's certainly true of Jacob, although, you know, we'll continue on. And so in verse 21, then Jacob said to Laban, "Give me my wife, for my time is completed, that I may go into her." And Laban gathered all the men of the place and made a feast. Now it came about in the evening that he took his daughter Leah and brought her to him, and Jacob went into her. Laban also gave his maid Zilpah to his daughter Leah as a maid. So it came about in the morning that, behold, it was Leah. And he said to Laban, "What is this you have done to me? Was it not for Rachel that I served with you? Why then have you deceived me?" But Laban said, "It is not the practice in our place to marry off the younger before the firstborn. Complete the week of this one, and we will give you the other also for the service which you shall serve with me for another 7 years." And Jacob did so and completed her week, and he gave him his daughter Rachel as his wife. So all of a sudden, the deceiver gets deceived, is really what happens here. He had deceived, and the contrast with how he had deceived his father and how he gets deceived by Laban here is brought out pretty starkly. In other words, you know, his father was deceived because he was blind, and here he gets deceived because the emphasis is it's dark and there's a veil and he can't see the girl, and so he like wakes up in the morning and it's the wrong girl. You know, so it's kind of like lack of vision, you know, that parallels. And also that phrase there where, you know, what did Jacob do? He switched the older for the younger. What happened here? Laban switches the older for the younger too. And even the emphasis here where it says, it is not our practice to marry off the younger before, and you'd kind of expect the older, but here it's the firstborn. Once again, kind of drawing you back to the firstborn in the Jacob and Esau story. That Esau was the firstborn, and yet Jacob was the one that was deceived and got the blessing and the blessing and the birthright. And also just that word deceived is the same word deceived earlier. So it seems to be the point here that Jacob has gotten what he deserved. That there, throughout Scripture, and especially in the Old Testament, God very much has a, I'll call it a tit for tat. There's an understanding of God's justice where you get what you deserve. And often that's shown in the fact that whatever you do in terms of your sin, somehow your punishment is related to that. And so we see that, I mean, it shows when I talk through the minor prophets over and over that concept keeps coming out that, you know, it's not that God is, you know, a God of retribution and, you know, the kind of God that's like, I'm going to get you for what you have done. But God is just. And so there is a sense in which you get what is right and what should be coming to you. And I think that seems to be the emphasis here is the one who is a deceiver has now been deceived. His own treachery, in one sense, has been turned on his head. And once again, going back to the sovereignty of God, in one sense, God has somewhat orchestrated this, even by leading him to Laban directly, you know, with Rachel there. And so, anyway, it's just funny. I mean, if you think about the story, even in the first place, that, I mean, I don't know how that's possible, but I mean, that's what happened. He wakes up in the morning and he was with the wrong girl. And so, he got duped and deceived, and Laban got the better of him. And when the funny thing is when Laban says it's not our practice to marry the younger before the firstborn, Jacob's kind of like dumbfounded. It's kind of like he's speechless. There's nothing he could say to it. Because in a sense, you know, maybe, I don't even know necessarily why, but maybe in a sense he realized, oh, this is coming back to me for what I've done, or maybe just the sense of, well, that's the practice. There's nothing I can do. And so Laban basically tricks him into working another 7 years for him. And so, as it goes on, Jacob, where did we finish off? Verse 28, and Jacob did so and completed a week and gave him his daughter Rachel as his wife. So, I don't know if you catch that, but he tricks him and he takes Leah. He finishes the wedding, like, honeymoon for a week, and then immediately gives him the other girl, and then he works another 7 years to pay it off. And so right off the bat, this deception, you're, you know, in one sense, it is what Jacob deserves, but you're going to see in the story that follows how that's going to result in trouble and turmoil for him. Because, you know, as it comes on, verse 29, Laban also gave his maid Bilhah to his daughter Rachel as her maid. So Jacob went into Rachel also. And indeed, he loved Rachel more than Leah, and he served with Laban for another 7 years. And this whole favoritism thing is going to be this huge problem within the family. And we're going to see just the results. And once again, the Jacob story is kind of, until you get to the very end of this thing, next week, it's just continual trouble because of all the deceit that's taken place. But yet, that's what's amazing is you watch these two threads kind of running alongside each other. On the one side, you have tons of deceit by tons of people, everyone involved in one sense, But on the other hand, you see how God's working even through that to bring about the promise. And so you kind of have these two things running alongside each other, and they seem incompatible, but God is always going to bring about his plan and his purpose. And that's really the overriding theme. And really the backdrop to that is, even in the midst of all the junk that's going on, you know, all this deception back and forth. And so it's just, once again, emphasizes the need to trust in God and the need to walk with him. Because they keep trying to do... Jacob's the kind of guy that's constantly trying to do things his own way and make it happen and deceive and this and that. And as a result, all that comes is turmoil when he should have just trusted God in the first place. We'll continue to see that running throughout this story. Okay, now look at the result as you come to verse 31. Now Yahweh saw that Leah was unloved, and he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. And Leah conceived and bore a son and named him Reuben, for she said, "Because Yahweh has seen my affliction, surely now my husband will love me." Then she conceived again and bore a son, "Because Yahweh has heard that I am unloved, he has therefore given me this son also." So she named him Simeon. And she conceived again and bore a son and said, "Now this time my husband will become attached to me, because I have borne him three sons." Therefore he was named Levi. And she conceived again and bore a son, said, "This time I will praise Yahweh." Therefore she named him Judah. Then she stopped bearing. And so as we're going to continue on, there's going to be this rivalry between these two wives. It's going to be like they're constantly trying to one-up each other. And so God, as the story starts off, because Leah was the unloved one, God kind of intervened and once again, kind of, if you will, gave Jacob what he deserved. You know, he loved Rachel, and so God blessed Leah, you know, as a result of that. And so now, of course, that's going to cause all kinds of tension in the family. We'll see, because now, you know, you see every time that Leah has a son, basically what she names him is like, "Hey, maybe now my husband will love me because I bore him a son." It's like one, two, three sons, and it's like her husband still doesn't love her. You know, there's still this favoritism, and you're going to see there's this constant... I mean, what a mess to be in. Can you imagine? I mean, just these two wives that are just in this friction and just battle, in a sense, with one another that's going to be developed as we just continue on here. And so finally, with her fourth son, it's almost like she gives up, in a sense. It's like, you know, this time I'm just going to praise the Lord. I'm just going to praise Yahweh, you know, even though she's still not loved. I don't want to go too much into it there. But all the names, there's a lot of word plays in that section with each of the names, because the names are fitting with each of the things that are said there. So in other words, with Reuben, you probably have a footnote. Let's see if mine does.
Hated.
What's that?
Hated.
Hated?
Hated. That's what mine said.
Interesting. Let's see.
The next one is heard.
Yeah, the next one is heard. There's some debate as to all what the meaning of all these names are. But there's probably... I didn't bring all my notes here, but the first one, some people have said means look a son.
Yeah.
You know, Reuben. Is that what you had?
Yeah, Reuben, see a son. Simeon, sounds like Hebrew for heard.
Yep.
Levi sounds like Hebrew
for attached. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And Judah is praise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Mine says, see a son, too. I was looking at verse 33. Oops.
Yeah, no problem. So, you know.
Oh, and I make it hated.
But anyway, you see that, you know, she names each of her sons based on the situation. It's like, look, a son. God has seen me. He's blessed me. He's opened my womb. And you know, God has heard me. Maybe now my husband will become attached to me. Each of these things, she names her sons. And it gives you, you know, it kind of sets the frame, if you will, for tension within the family later. And even we know late throughout Israel's history, there's tension between the tribes. Ultimately, that results in the divided kingdom. And it started all the way at the beginning, in one sense, because of, you know, the results of sin, in short. Where there's constant friction in the family. And so let's just kind of continue reading on and see this friction just continue to play out. Now when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, she became jealous of her sister. And she said to Jacob, give me children or else I die. Okay, obviously there's some friction in the family here, right? I mean, this, once again, Jacob is not the man you want to be at this moment in time. Yeah, your two wives just going at it. Then Jacob's anger burned against Rachel, and he said, am I in the place of God who has withheld from you the fruit of your womb? So, once again, not necessarily the most gentle response to his wife. It's caused even now friction between him and his wife, and he's like, you know, who are you, woman, to, you know, and just like, you see like this triangle of trouble. It's just as it continues on. And so she says, here's my maid Bilhah, go to her that she may bear on my knees, that through her I too may have children. So in other words, she'll take my place, you know, and she'll bear children so that I could build a house for myself. And so she gave him her maid Bilhah as a wife, and Jacob went into her, and Bilhah conceived and bore Jacob a son. Then Rachel said, God has vindicated me and has indeed heard my voice and has given me a son. Therefore she named him Dan. Which has to do with vindication in a sense. And Rachel's maid Bilhah conceived again and bore Jacob a second son. And so Rachel said, with mighty wrestlings I have wrestled with my sister, and I have indeed prevailed. And she named him Naphtali. Right? So it's like you see the constant friction between here. And so when Leah saw that she had stopped bearing, she took her maid Zilpah and gave her to Jacob. It's like they're constantly trying to one-up each other, right? Just like back and forth, back and forth. And so Zilpah, you know, is given to Jacob as a wife, and Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob a son. Then Leah said, how fortunate. So she named him Gad, which basically means fortunate. And Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob a second son. Then Leah said, happy am I, for women shall call me happy. So she named him Asher, which means happy. Now in the days of wheat harvest, Reuben went and found mandrakes in the field and brought them to his mother Leah. Then Rachel said to Leah, please give me some of your son's mandrakes. And you have to understand here that the mandrakes were basically thought to be an aphrodisiac. And so they thought that they would help, you know, well, Rachel thought that they would help her not be barren anymore. It's kind of a superstitious kind of a thing that she's trying to use. And so she said to her, is it a small matter for you to take my husband? And would you take also my son's mandrakes? And so Rachel said, therefore, he may lie with you tonight in return for your son's mandrakes. I mean, I hope you feel just the tension. And it's like, are you kidding me? Like, what a mess. What a mess. And so when Jacob came in the field in the evening, then Leah went out to meet him and said, you must come in to me, for I have surely hired you with my son's mandrakes. So he lay with her that night. And God gave heed to Leah, and she conceived and bore Jacob a fifth son. Then Leah said, God has given me my wages because I gave my maid to my husband, so she named him Issachar. And Leah conceived again and bore a sixth son to Jacob. Then Leah said, God has endowed me with a good gift. Now my husband will dwell with me because I have borne him six sons, so she named him Zebulun. And afterwards she bore a daughter and named her Dinah. Then God remembered Rachel. And God gave heed to her and opened her womb. So she conceived and bore a son and said, God has taken away my reproach. And she named him Joseph, saying, may Yahweh give me another son. So I don't need to spend too much time dealing with that. I think we've made the point sufficiently clear. But you just kind of see the results. Just like Jacob's deception of Esau and Jacob's deception of his father resulted in a split in that family. You know, the mess of Laban's deception and the result even of Jacob's original deception that caused him to be here in the first place. You just kind of see the mess he's in because of everything that's happened. But at the same time, when you're reading this from the perspective of the Israelites, it also shows all these birth of all these children and in a sense God blessing in the midst of it and even in a sense in spite of, you know, the fact that all this has been going on. And that's exactly what we're going to continue to see in the story. Laban and Jacob are going to be going at it some more with deception back and forth. And as a result, just, or I should say, in spite of that, God is going to continue to bless Jacob. And so now he's blessed him with this, all these children, in a sense, a household. And next he's going to bless him with flocks and, in a sense, his possessions. And so it's just, it's ironic, I guess. It's somewhat shocking that in the midst of all this mess, God is still blessing. But I think that that still is, that's the main point that the author's trying to show, is that God has given this promise, and so let's watch that continue to go in spite of everything that's going on. And ultimately, as we said, hopefully we'll get there tonight, we'll see that finally God will humble him and cause him to see that he needs to depend on the Lord rather than trying to bring about God's plan by deceit. Okay, so verse 25. Now it came about when Rachel had borne Joseph that Jacob said to Laban, "Send me away that I may go to my own place and to my own country. Give me my wives and my children for whom I have served you, and let me depart. For you yourself know my service which I have rendered you." But Laban said to him, "If now it pleases you, stay with me. I have divined that Yahweh has blessed me on your account." Does that sound reminiscent of anything? Certainly every time you see the word blessing in this book, you got to take note of it. You know, and so Laban now is even forced to recognize God's blessing on Jacob. And so Jacob's wanting to leave and go back to the land of Israel and go back to his homeland. But Laban, because he recognizes Jacob's blessing, or God's blessing, I should say, on Jacob, is saying, "Hey, you stay here and continue to work for me." Because he recognizes that blessing is coming through Jacob. So we've seen that all along, right? In the story, we've seen that whoever was in association with Abraham was blessed, and even the Philistines wanted to make a peace treaty with him because he was blessed, and they acknowledged his blessing. Same thing with Isaac and Abimelech. Same thing now with Jacob. You know, God promised to bless Abraham's seed, and God is doing so. God is doing so, and in a way that forces others to acknowledge God's blessing. Laban's even funny here, where it says, "I have divined." It's kind of the word for like pagan divination. In other words, like magic and sorcery. And so, you know, he's obviously not put in a good light with that note right there. Nonetheless, he recognizes the blessing upon Jacob, and so he wants him to stay. And so, he continued, "Name me your wages, and I will give it." But he said to him, "You yourself know I have served you, and how your cattle have fared with me. For you had little before I came, and it increased to a multitude, and Yahweh has blessed you wherever I turned. But now, when shall I provide for my own household also?" So in other words, I've been serving you for 14 years, right? And God has just been blessing Laban as a result. That's a long time. I mean, it's easy to pass over that, but Jacob is serving Laban for a long time. You know, "But now, when shall I provide for my own household?" And so he said, "What shall I give you?" And Jacob says, "You shall not give me anything. If you will do this one thing for me, I will again pasture and keep your flock. Let me pass through your entire flock today, removing from there every speckled and spotted sheep, and every black one among the lambs, and the spotted and speckled among the goats, and such shall be my wages. So my honesty will answer for me later when you come concerning my wages. Every one that is not speckled and spotted among the goats and black among the lambs, if found with me, will be considered stolen." And Laban said, "Good, it will be done according to your word." Now, basically, the rest of this story will continue on in just a second, but just a little background here. Basically, all the abnormally colored sheep and goats are the ones that Jacob is suggesting be his wages. So normally, that would be a small percentage of the flock. So one commentary said that based on some, you know, demographic studies of animals or whatever that they did, that this would be under 20% of the flock. So, I don't know, 15, 10%, somewhere in that range maybe of the flock, that just the abnormally colored animals. And so, you know, Laban is thinking, okay, that's pretty good because, you know, I'm giving you 10% and God is blessing me as a result. And so that sounds like a good deal for me. You know, I'll be blessed and I'll give you a little bit of wages. And so he's like, good. But then notice what he does, verse 35. Once again, Laban and Jacob are trying, just like Jacob's two wives are trying to outdo each other in like having children, Laban and Jacob keep trying to one-up each other in deceitfulness and treachery. So notice what Laban does. So he removed on that day the striped and spotted male goats and all the speckled and spotted female goats, everyone with white in it, and all the black ones among the sheep, and gave them into the care of his son. Sorry, that's not the deceitful part. So he takes all the ones that are supposed to be Jacob's and gives them to his sons. But notice this, and he put a distance of 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob, and Jacob fed or shepherded the rest of Laban's flock. So it seems like what he's doing here is separating it out so that the speckled and the spotted won't intermix with the other ones and multiply. Now, once again, it's tough here because all the pronouns and things are tough, and just even the like exactly what's going on with the speckled and the spotted is not all that clear. So even all the commentators go back and forth on this. But I guess I would basically say it seems fairly clear just through reading here that they're trying to kind of like manipulate the situation, both of them, to make it so that it's better for them. And all the details of how they do it, it's kind of weird, you know, but I think we'll see the overall point as we walk through here. But there seems to be that Laban's putting this separation. That seems to be so that, you know, Jacob won't get as many flocks. And then notice what Jacob's going to do. Then Jacob took fresh rods of poplar and almond and plane trees and peeled white stripes in them, exposing white which is in the rods. And he set the rods which he had peeled in front of the flocks in the gutters, even in the watering troughs where the flocks came to drink, and they mated when they came to drink. So the flocks mated by the rods, and the flocks brought forth stripes, speckled and spotted. And Jacob separated the lambs and made the flocks face toward the striped and all the black in the flock of Laban. And he put his own herds apart, and he did not put them with Laban's flock. Moreover, it came about whenever the stronger of the flock were mating, that Jacob would place the rods in the side of the flock in the gutters, so that they might mate by the rods. But when the flock was feeble, he did not put them in. So the feebler were Laban's, and the stronger Jacob's. So the man became extremely prosperous, and had large flocks, and female and male servants, and camels and donkeys. Okay, so you get the, once again, the details of what exactly is he doing here is not all that clear. Some people are saying it's kind of like a superstitious practice that Jacob was practicing, like peeling these stripes. And like basically it says that he took these sticks and peeled them so that there were white stripes in them. And some people think that he was being somewhat superstitious. I don't know if that's necessarily the point. Obviously, he's doing something with the mating here, where he's like trying to get certain flocks to mate with others, so that obviously it talks about he's trying to get it when the strong of the flock are mating, he'll get those and Laban will get the weaker. But whatever exactly he's doing, the point is pretty clear that he's trying to manipulate the situation so that his flocks grow and Laban's decrease, right? He's trying to work it all out for his own good and for his own best. And so verse 43 says, as a result of all this, his flocks became prosperous, and just he extremely, you know, grew. But what we're going to see as we continue on, and really what is the point, that it's not even Jacob's treachery or his manipulation of the situation that ultimately is what is causing him to be blessed. You know, whatever he's doing with these rods and sticks and blah, 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 with all these different flocks, and whatever Laban's trying to do to make sure that Jacob gets cheated, whatever Jacob's trying to do to cheat Laban, ultimately God's just going to be blessing Jacob, because that's what God has set out to do. And as we read on in chapter 31, that's what Jacob is actually ultimately going to confess, is that God is the one that blessed him. And so it's not, even despite the deceit and everything that's going on, that's not the ultimate cause of everything. And the ultimate cause of the blessing is God. And so, once again, you see, I guess I'd say, just this deception going back and forth. Okay, any questions or comments? Okay.
I had one, like, going back, like, a little bit before the livestock part. Like, Why is there never a time where God just kind of like, hold on, okay, like, what's with everyone just having sex with each other and saying, hey, you have sex with this one, it's okay, and have this child, and how is that just okay? I'm just confused on that, you know, because later on it's just like there's such specific, you know, instruction when it comes to marriage and then, you know, customs with, like, servants and, you know, concubines and everything, so I'm just...
Yeah, my basic take would be this, is that obviously it's before the law. Obviously, I mean, we don't know exactly what they had in terms of, I mean, so far in Genesis, we don't have anything really in terms of laws, you know. And so basically, if I were to look at it, I would say it's clear if you go all the way back to the beginning in Genesis 1, 2, 3 there, Genesis 1 and 2 primarily, that it was intended to be one man or one wife, and they should have known that. But basically, I would say is they didn't have the same level of revelation that we do, and therefore they didn't have the same level of culpability either. And so it's not that I wouldn't say that it wasn't wrong. I would say that it is wrong, and even I would say that the authors probably look at the trouble that's coming as a result. You know, so the author may be even suggesting that. But I think it's not at the level where it's strictly prohibited. You know, I guess I should say explicitly in a law. You know, even Paul, you know, in Romans, I mean, not to like cross-reference, but Paul talks about when the law came in, the transgression increased. You know, and there's just a higher level of culpability there. And so, and I think the same is probably true of us. You know, sometimes we do things, you know, maybe when we're immature Christians or just new in the faith that, I mean, I've heard of, you know, people are get saved and they don't even know it's wrong to, whatever, let's say cuss or whatever, some habit that they've kind of taken over from their unsaved life. And so they're going on and doing this, but then all of a sudden when they know that it's wrong, then the level of culpability goes up. And so I think it's in some sense similar. So that's basically how I'd explain it. It was wrong, but it wasn't so clear that it was wrong that the repercussions of it wasn't as high as it is for us. I don't know if that sufficiently answers it.
Sounds like he's asking a little different of a question. I don't know. I don't want to speak for you, but I was thinking, when you said what you said, I was somewhat thinking the same thing. At what point in this narrative is God going to break through and start saying enough is enough? And as I've been reading through and hearing, I've been thinking, you know, it seems like at this point, that's not the narrative. That's not like the objective of this narrative. But there's these other issues like the blessing, mm-hmm. the seed, the mm-hmm. land, all these other issues that seem to be more priority. And there's so much sin involved. If the writer at this point had to break in at every point and say, you know, this is against the law, or because of their sin, God did this. I mean, you couldn't finish the narrative, in a sense. Is that a fair
statement? And I think,
I don't know if that's exactly what you're asking. But
no, that's a good question. And I think, partly just by telling the story, he doesn't need to really say, ooh, look how bad that is. You're kind of just, I mean, you have to remember, this is the Israelites who have received the law, who are reading this. And so they're going to be reading this going, you know, like, they're going to be like, ooh, that's not good. And so it's like, you don't even necessarily have to put too much comment on it. And ultimately, I think as you get on in the story, and ultimately God humbles Jacob, and there's that transfer, that's that complete turnaround in his life, which we'll hope to get to when his name is changed to Israel, that's the point that God finally gets a hold of him and says, all right, I'm going to humble you, we'll get there. And so it's kind of like, maybe, you know, it's going along, but it will stop as God finally, you know, gets the hold of Jacob and teaches him the lesson that he should have been learning all along, you know. So I don't know if that exactly answers your question, but you're right. The emphasis here is more about God's faithfulness than it is about Jacob's deception or this or that. But in a sense, I would say that as I see it, Jacob's deception and Laban's deception and the turmoil within the family and all these things only highlights God's faithfulness all the more then. Because it shows even in spite of all those things, God can still work out his plan. You know, and so you know, on the one hand, you see with maybe with Abraham a little bit more, how Abraham's faithfulness results in God's blessing. But here now you almost see somewhat of a similar but a different twist on it, where even in spite of all these things, God's plan is going to continue. And so even in, when we get to the Joseph story, we're going to see something similar too. In spite of all this mishap and world events and all this, that God's plan still... And even, for example, I would say, I mean, I haven't even got to that section yet, but I'm suspecting that one of the main points of the whole story is when Joseph says, you know, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. Right? I'm sure that that's one of the main points of the story, is all this sin of what they have done, God used that for good. And so, a similar point here, right? Jacob wasn't doing things righteously and trusting in the Lord by trying to deceive Laban, but yet God is still working it out and still blessing him because of God's promises. It's good. All right, I lost track of where we were.
We're done with
30. We just finished 30, right?
Yeah.
All right, we got to keep rolling here. So, chapter 31. Now Jacob heard the words of Laban's son, saying, Jacob has taken away all that was our father's, and from what belonged to our father he has made all this wealth. And Jacob saw the attitude of Laban, and behold, it was not friendly towards him as formerly. Then Yahweh said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you. So Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah to his flock in the field, and said to them, I see your father's attitude that is not friendly toward me as formerly, but the God of my father has been with me. And you know that I have served your father with all my strength, yet your father has cheated me and changed my wages 10 times. However, God did not allow him to hurt me. If he spoke thus, the speckled shall be your wages, then all the flock brought forth speckled. And if he spoke thus, the striped shall be your wages, then all the flock brought forth striped. Thus God has taken away your father's livestock and given them to me. So there you see, in the previous chapter, this is just a retelling of the previous chapter in Jacob's own words. In the previous chapter, it's like, because of Jacob's manipulation and these rods and stripes and whatever, it seems to be that that's why he has all these flocks. But then when he retells it from this other perspective, one is kind of like the human perspective and the divine perspective in a sense. From a human standpoint, it looks like maybe manipulation is why he has all these flocks, because he kind of tricked Laban with this scheme. But then when he recounts it, it's really ultimately because God has blessed him. And as much as Laban tried to cheat him by like saying, stripes are your wages, spotted, or this, and just like changing things up on him, ultimately God was like making it so that that would work out so that Jacob would be blessed no matter what. So ultimately, as you step back, it doesn't matter what happens, the schemes aren't what's doing it, it's God is the one that's bringing about the blessing. And so as a result, you know, verse 9, God has taken away your father's livestock and given them to me. And it came about at the time when the flock were mating, I lifted up my eyes and saw in a dream, and behold, the male goats were mating, were striped, speckled, and mottled. Then the angel of God said to me in a dream, Jacob, and I said, here I am. And he said, lift up now your eyes and see all the male goats which are mating are striped, speckled, and mottled. For I have seen all that Laban has been doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar, where you made a vow to me. Now arise, leave this land, and return to the land of your birth. So, once again, Jacob here is being obedient to the Lord. God came to him and says, go back home, I will be with you. And so Jacob takes action. And so God reminds him that he is his God, that he was the God of Bethel that appeared to him and reassured him of his blessing. And so he's now trying to convince his wives to go with him. And so he tells them, recounts the story to them. And so verse 14, Rachel and Leah answered and said to him, do we still have any portion or inheritance in our father's house? Are we not reckoned by him as foreigners? For he sold us and also entirely consumed our purchase price. Surely all the wealth which God has taken away from our father belongs to us and our children. Now then, do whatever God has said to you. Then Jacob arose and put his children and his wives upon camels, and he drove away all his livestock and all his property which he had gathered, his acquired livestock, which he had gathered in Paddan Aram, to go to the land of Canaan to his father Isaac. When Laban had gone to shear his flock, then Rachel stole the household idols that were her father's. And Jacob deceived Laban the Aramean by not telling him that he was fleeing. So he fled with all that he had, and he arose and crossed the Euphrates River and set his face towards the hill country of Gilead. Now it's interesting there. Hopefully you have a footnote of on verse 20, because we'll see the key word of this chapter probably is stole. That's one of the main key words. It's only occurs, I think, like 12 times in Genesis, and 8 of them are in this chapter. And not only did Rachel steal Laban's household idols, but here it says that Jacob stole the heart of Laban, literally, using the exact same word. And so I think it is kind of pointing out his, and obviously the meaning behind it is he deceived Laban, as our translations put it. But it is the same word for steal, and definitely puts a negative connotation with on top of Jacob. It's the same exact word. You go to the Ten Commandments, it says, you shall never steal. Same word that occurs 8 times here. And so it somewhat, I think, shows just the deception of Jacob, which we've seen all along. And so, you know, once again, God doesn't condone what he is doing, but he still blesses him because he's the line of promise all throughout. And so, I mean, and we see the consequences all throughout as well of his deception, just the turmoil that comes to his own family and how his father-in-law is going to chase him down and all that happens as a result. But God is still blessing. And so he's fleeing. He's having to run away. Of course he's got to flee. They've been trying to cheat each other this whole time. And, you know, you could tell there's just animosity within the family. Jacob says, you know, his face isn't towards me as formerly. It's like, I guess Laban was scowling at him every time he saw him or something, you know, because he recognized that, you know, just the tension of Jacob basically stealing his flocks. And so verse 22, when it was told Laban on the third day that Jacob had fled, then he took his kinsmen with him and pursued him a distance of 7 days' journey, and he overtook him in the hill country of Gilead. And God came to Laban the Aramean in a dream of the night and said to him, be careful or guard yourself that you do not speak to Jacob either good or bad. And Laban caught up with Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the hill country, and Laban with his kinsmen camped in the hill country of Gilead. Then Laban said to Jacob, what have you done by deceiving me and carrying away my daughters like captives of the sword? Why did you flee secretly and deceive me and did not tell me, so that I might have sent you away with joy and with songs, with timbrel and with lyre, and did not allow me to kiss my sons and my daughters? Now you have done foolishly. It is in my power to do you harm, but the God of your father spoke to me last night, saying, be careful not to speak either good or bad to Jacob. And now you have indeed gone away because you have longed greatly for your father's house. But why did you steal my gods? And so the language in here is very militaristic. It's like he pursued, and he's like, why did you drive away my family like captives? And he rebukes Jacob for secretly stealing away. And once again, you just see the tension and the deception back and forth. And Laban's rebuking Jacob for this. And ultimately, as Laban pursues him and overtakes him, what's the only thing that prevents Jacob from being in bad trouble?
Well, God speaking directly to Laban.
Right. Ultimately, God's the one that intervened and protected Jacob. Right? That's the only thing. It's God's blessing upon Jacob is the only thing that in one sense preserves him here. And really the same thing that's going to happen when he meets Esau later. You know, it's God's protection. It's God's blessing. Once again, just shows that God's going to bring about what he has said. And so even in spite of all this deception, and so verse 31, then Jacob answered and said, because I was afraid, for I said, lest you would take your daughters from me by force. The one with whom you shall find the gods shall not live. In the presence of our kinsmen, point out what is yours among my belongings and take it for yourself. For Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them. His favorite wife had stolen these household idols. You know, and once again, just look at the trouble that's bringing upon Jacob, potentially. Just this stealing that's going on. And so, as the tension rises, verse 33, Laban went into Jacob's tent, and into Leah's tent, and into the tent of the two maids, and you can kind of feel the tension rising as he's approaching Rachel's tent, and he did not find them. Then he went out of Leah's tent and entered Rachel's tent, you know, and you're kind of like is he going to find the household idols? Now Rachel had taken the household idols and put them in the camel's saddle, and she sat on them. And Laban felt all through the tent, but he did not find them. And she said to her father, "Let not my lord be angry that I cannot rise before you, for the manner of woman is upon me." So he searched, but he did not find the household idols. Now, I don't know if she's just flat out lying to him or if that was actually the case, but either way, she stole the idols and was hiding them and was deceiving her father about it. And it's just, you know, she got away with it, and ultimately it's God's providence that was the case, but obviously this is not being condoned. And even the household idols, I mean, you know, why does she want idols in the first place? I mean, that's somewhat troublesome and problematic even in and of itself. But once again, the point of the narrative is not out to point out, I don't think necessarily here, just the great valor and faith of these individuals, at least at this moment in time. And so I tend to think that she just flat out lied to her father so that he wouldn't find the idols, but there's not necessarily proof of that. And so then Jacob becomes angry, right? Because Jacob doesn't know about any of this. And so Jacob became angry and contended with Laban, and Jacob answered and said to Laban, "What is my transgression? What is my sin that you have hotly pursued me? Though you have felt through all my goods, what have you found of all your household goods? Set it here before my kinsmen and your kinsmen, that they may decide between us two. These 20 years I have been with you, your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried, nor have I eaten the rams of your flocks. That which was torn of beasts I did not bring to you, I bore the loss of it myself. You acquired of it my hand, whether stolen by day or stolen by night." And so Jacob's just emphasizing his honesty with Laban throughout the process. "Thus I was by day the heat consumed me, and the frost by night, my sleep fled from my eyes. These 20 years I have been in your house. I served you 14 years for your two daughters and 6 years for your flock, and you changed my wages 10 times. And here's so much of the point. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had not been for me, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God has seen my affliction and the toil of my hands, so he rendered judgment last night." And ultimately, it's God's blessing. It's only because of God and not even because of Jacob himself. And so as it continues on, the two of them are going to make a covenant, and even once again, as we continue to see, because God's blessing is so evidently upon Jacob, it forces those who are around him to come to terms with him. And so ultimately, that's what has to happen even with Laban. Laban has, as much as Laban is, you know, in a sense, against Jacob and has hotly pursued him and is angry, and they kind of, in one sense, hate each other, because God's evident blessing upon Jacob, it forces people around him to come to terms with who he is. And so then Laban answered and said to Jacob, verse 43, "The daughters are my daughters, and the children are my children, the flocks are my flocks, and all that you see is mine. But what can I do this day to these my daughters or to their children whom they have borne? So now come, let us make a covenant, you and I, and let it be a witness between you and me." And then Jacob took a stone and set it up as a pillar. And Jacob said to his kinsmen, "Gather stones." So they took stones and made a heap, and they ate there by the heap. Now Laban called it Jegar Sahadu'utha, but Jacob called it Galeed. Then Laban said, "This heap is a witness between you and me this day." Therefore, it was named Galeed. Once again, both that long name, Jagar Sahadutha, and Galeed mean a heap of witness, or a pile of stones as a witness. And so once again, they make this treaty between the two of them, this covenant. And Laban said, "This heap is a witness between you and me this day, therefore is named Galeed." And Mitzpah, for he said, "May Yahweh watch between you and me when we are absent from one another. If you mistreat my daughters or take wives besides my daughters, although no man is with us, see, God is witness between you and me." And Laban said to Jacob, "Behold this heap, and behold this the pillar which I have set between you and me. This heap is a witness, and the pillar is a witness, that I will not pass by this heap to you for harm, and you will not pass by this heap and this pillar to me for harm. The God of Abraham and the God of Nahor and the God of their father judge between us." So Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac. Then Jacob offered a sacrifice on the mountain and called his kinsmen to the meal, and they ate the meal and spent the night on the mountain. And early in the morning, Laban arose and kissed his sons and daughters and blessed them. Then Laban departed and returned to his place. So in spite of all the friction, in spite of all the tension and all the turmoil, Laban has to, in one sense, acquiesce. He has to give up, and he has to ultimately make a treaty with Jacob, because God is blessing him and because God is the one that's working through him. And I think that's the point of this section. All right. Any questions before we press on to the last chapter for tonight? Okay, we'll keep rolling. Want to keep the big picture before us, because really the big picture is just the point of God's faithfulness. "Now as Jacob went on his way, the angels of God met him. And Jacob said when he saw them, 'This is God's camp.' So he named that place Mahanaim." Interesting, as Jacob comes back into the promised land, just this kind of obscure reference to the angels of God and this huge encampment, I guess, of angels. And Jacob sees it and he recognizes it. And, you know, why is that there? Why does God, you know, what do these angels have to do with anything? In just a moment, we're going to see he wrestles with God himself. And I think a point of it is it should have been just a reminder for Jacob of the power of God as he comes in back to the promised land. Just as when he left, God showed him all these angels going up and down a staircase. Here, as he's coming back in, once again, he has an interaction with angels. And it should have just reminded him, I think, of God's power. But he didn't necessarily, you know, whether or not he got the message. Well, in a sense, he did. He started at this chapter is finally when Jacob finally starts to get the point. And so I think that it's a fitting time that he's been in exile all these years. He left Bethel, and when God appeared to him there and told him that he would return. And so now as he's coming back to the promised land, this appearance of angels once again. Anyway, we'll see how he responds. "Then Jacob sent messengers before him to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. He also commanded them, saying, 'Thus you shall say to my lord Esau, thus says your servant Jacob, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed until now. I have oxen and donkeys and flocks and male and female servants, and I have sent to tell my lord that I might find favor in your sight.' And the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, 'We came to your brother Esau, and furthermore, he is coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him.' Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people who were with him, and the flocks and the herds and the camels into two companies. For he said, 'If Esau comes to the one company and attacks it, then the company which is left will escape.'" You know, once worst case scenario planning at this point. He's coming back in, he sees Esau coming with 400 men, and he's terrified. And here, I think, is finally where Jacob's perspective is starting to change. This is one that he's not going to be easily able to finagle his way out of. You know, and so what happens? And Jacob said, is finally Jacob prays. Right? Finally Jacob is going to pray. And ultimately God is going to hear his prayer, and that's why Esau is not going to come and wipe him out. Because obviously last we left Esau, he was not a happy camper. He wanted to kill Jacob. And so as Jacob comes back, it's only God's work in Esau's heart that is going to preserve Jacob. And so Jacob says in verse 9, he prays, and finally there's this change within Jacob. He says, "O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, Yahweh, who did save to me, return to your country and to your relatives, and I will prosper you. I am unworthy of all the loving kindness and of all the faithfulness which thou hast shown to thy servant. For with my staff only I crossed this Jordan. Now I have become two companies. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he come and attack me, the mothers with the children. For thou didst say, I will surely prosper you and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude." So finally he's forced to go to the Lord in prayer. And he's finally humbled to that point, and he cries out to God, and you know, he still kind of plans, you know, like, let's set up the two camps and let's, but ultimately it's not his planning that's going to deliver him, right? All this plan about, you know, plan A, plan B, camp A, camp B, you know, send all the flocks ahead of time to like appease Esau's anger. None of that, as we are going to continue on in the story, does anything. Right, that Esau doesn't come off mad. It's like, oh, because all these flocks, you give me all these flocks, now I'm okay with you. You know, now I'm not going to kill you. You know, it's only God's working in Esau's heart. And so you see all this in one sense. Jacob's the schemer. He's always got a plan for everything. But ultimately, you know, it's not that this plan was right or wrong. That's not even the point. But all his scheming and planning didn't amount for anything. It's the prayer that ultimately is what worked. And I think that's the emphasis here. Is finally, you know, he's not trying to, like, work it out with the sheep and the stripes and the this and the that. And he's not trying to steal the birthright and, you know, bargain for the, steal the blessing and bargain for the birthright. He's not trying to manipulate the situation to do this or that. Finally, he prays. And God is going to answer and hear his prayer. And that, I think, is so much the point of where we finally come full circle when it comes to Jacob. And so he prays. And so he spent the night there, and then he selected from what he had with him a present for his brother Esau, 200 female goats and 20 male goats and 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 milking camels and their colts and 40 cows and 10 bulls and 20 female donkeys and 10 male donkeys. That's a lot of animals. I mean, he's like, that's a lot. And he delivered them into the hand of his servants, every drove by itself. And he said to his servants, "Pass on before me and put a space between the droves." It's like, you know, send some, put a space. Some send, you know, he's desperate, you know. And he
diversified.
Yeah, he's diverted, exactly. And he commanded the one in front, saying, "When my brother Esau meets you and asks you, saying, 'To whom do you belong, and where are you going, and to whom do all these animals in front of you belong?' then you shall say, 'These belong to your servant Jacob. It is a present sent to my lord Esau, and behold, he is also behind us.' Then he commanded also the second and the third, and all those who followed the droves, saying, 'After this manner you shall speak to Esau when you find him.'" It's like everyone's going to keep saying the same thing, here, my lord, you know, just trying to appease him. "And you shall say, 'Behold, your servant Jacob is also behind us.' For he said, 'I will appease him with the present that goes before me. Then afterwards I will see his face. Perhaps he will accept me.' So the present passed on before him while he himself spent that night in the camp." So he's got this grand plan, this scheme of how he's going to try to appease his brother. But ultimately, as this chapter ends, we'll see... We'll see what ultimately causes him to prevail. "And so now he arose that same night and took his two wives and his two maids and his 11 children across the ford of the Jabbok. And he took them and sent them across the stream, and he sent across whatever he had." And so then we're going to end with this last section, which I think is such a turning point within the whole narrative. Everything is so significant for the whole point of everything up to this point. Then Jacob was left alone. It's significant, you know, he's helpless and defenseless. He's alone. And a man wrestled with him until daybreak. Just out of nowhere, right? This man just shows up and they're wrestling. And even it's interesting, there's somewhat of a play on words between Jacob and Jabbok and wrestled. All three of those words sound very similar. So you could say Jacob, it's like Jacob, Jacob, Jabbok. You know, that's not exactly it, but it kind of all goes together like that, where Jacob is wrestling at the Jabbok. And so when he saw that he had not prevailed against him, and this is this man, he touched the socket of his thigh, so the socket of Jacob's thigh was dislocated while he wrestled with him. Then he said, "Let me go, for the dawn is breaking." But he said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." So he said, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." He said, "Your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed." Then Jacob asked him and said, "Please tell me your name." But he said, "Why is it that you ask my name?" And he blessed him there. So Jacob named the place Peniel, for he said, "I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been preserved." Now the sun rose upon him just as he crossed over Peniel, and he was limping on his thigh. Therefore to this day the sons of Israel do not eat the sinew of the hip, which is on the socket of the thigh, because he touched the socket of Jacob's thigh in the sinew of the hip. Now, you know, this is obviously a very significant story within the flow of this narrative, and it's not as detailed maybe as we would like in terms of all the point of it, but it seems to me that the basic point is this. Obviously, the significance is that this is a when there's a change of name, there's a transformation that takes place there. Like, the change of name signifies the change in character, and Jacob basically means deceiver. Or it's closely associated with that. It has to do with the fact that he was grabbing his brother's heel and seeking to supplant his brother. And so this change of name has to do, in one sense, with the change of his character, that finally the one who has been kind of deceiving all along has sought the Lord and sought to do things by prayer and by the Lord's methods. And it seems to me that the point is Jacob, this man who so much is seeking to do things his own power, his own strength, is wrestling with this angel and seeking to prevail, but it's not until ultimately the angel weakens him and in one sense touches his thigh so that he's helpless and weak at that point, that at that point Jacob is not wrestling anymore, but he's just clinging on to the man and saying, "Bless me, bless me." And so it seems that the point of the story is that God has broken Jacob of his self-sufficiency and really taught him that, you know, "I win," you know, when he touches his thigh, and Jacob is forced to just ask for God's blessing. And so his name is changed to Israel, because he's no longer the one that's seeking to do things in his own power, but now is the one who's been transformed to be seeking God. And even just his prayer earlier in the chapter seems to show that shift in direction. And so it seems like we see a transformed man in Jacob now. It seems like he's no longer the man who's seeking to do things in his own power and his own strength, but through all these things that God has brought him to, he's finally caused to see that he needs the Lord to do it. And so that's basically how I see the flow of this narrative, is that finally God meets him where he's at, humbles him, teaches him that he cannot do things on his own, and then changes his name. It's just such a significant life-transforming event in Jacob's life.
Could it be possible, the reason why God, obviously God knows his name, but could it be also referring back to when he lies to his father? He says he's Esau. Whether his name is Jacob, or...
I don't know. I haven't thought about that. I have to think about that.
Is Israel, does it strive with God, or God strives?
There's debate. It's not clear. Well, as with so many of these names, that the etymology is it comes back to the name is not... You know, the explanation there is for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. And so, you know, but exactly how, you know, literally what the name derives from, it obviously has to do with that striving, but it doesn't exactly define it. And so as we come, we're not quite finished with the Jacob story, which we'll get to, we'll finish off next week as we get to chapter 36. But certainly I think, hopefully we're seeing just the main overriding theme here, which is God's promises do not fail. Despite deception, despite all this trouble and turmoil and all these things, God continues to bless Jacob. You know, even though he's got all this friction and infighting in his family, God continues to bless Jacob. Even though, you know, Laban's deception and Jacob's deception, God continues to bless, continues to bring about his promise, continues to fulfill what he has said, and is ultimately going to bring about the whole nation of Israel through all of this. And so it points to God's faithfulness, not so much to Jacob's faithfulness, but ultimately God does, I would say, break Jacob. And Jacob does seek the Lord. And God brought him to that place of humility after all these situations to where he comes to the place where he seeks the Lord. And so, great lessons for us there just about seeking the Lord and not trying to do things from our own strength and our own manipulation or deceit. You know, even things that are good, it might seem like, hey, if, you know, if this is good, I'm going to do whatever it takes to get there. But so much of the lesson, I think, of this for us is if God said he's going to bring something about, he's going to bring it about. You don't have to manipulate. You don't have to deceive. You don't have to bring it about your own way. You have to seek the Lord in prayer. You have to depend upon him and on his power, right? And even as the Israelites are going into the promised land, right? Isn't that so much the point? Right, it's not about their armies. It's not about the strength of their sword. Right, it's about walking around Jericho 7 times and watching the walls fall down. Right, that's the lesson that they needed. They needed that lesson of God's the one that fights for you. You need to trust him. Yes, you know, even when, you know, so many times they try to go into battle and take the promised land in their own strength. Right, and what happened in those cases? They got defeated. Right. Whether it be Ai, where they get defeated, whether it be, you could go to those battles where they tried to do it in their own strength, and they never succeeded. But when they did it God's way, they're trusting in him, he fought the battle for them. And so that really is so much the lesson here is, don't try to achieve even something that's good by your own means and your own power, but therefore just the importance of prayer, you know, obviously of honesty, and not trying to be deceptive and, or, you know, to bring about anything good from means that are not good. So, but ultimately, the biggest point is just trust in the Lord, because he's faithful, he will keep his promises, he will keep his word, and he will bring all these things about, even in spite of ourselves. And so, just great, great lessons for us. Okay, any other closing thoughts or comments?
It says that he's striven with God and prevailed. Sounds like you're saying that that's more of like a cling to, or
no, I mean,
to like the word walk with God. Like I've looked at that in a lot of different contexts, and but to talk about striving with God and prevailing, that's like out of my normal understanding of our relationship of walking with God.
Right.
But you're saying here, like, this shows a change of his character where he was a deceiver and trying to do things on his own and manipulate, and now he's really clinging to God, he's praying to him. But then you have this statement of him striving with God and men and prevailing. And
yeah, so for sure. I mean, it's a good question. I mean, I think it talks about, in one sense, the perseverance of his faith, that he didn't, like, if you look at verse 26 is kind of where I was getting that from. He said, let me go, for the dawn is breaking. He said, I will not let you go. That's the idea. I will. He's clinging to him there. And so, I don't necessarily... I could be missing the point a little bit there, but it seems like they were wrestling, but then the wrestling match is over when his hip gets touched. It's like you're done, you know? I mean, he just completely wrenched him of his strength, but Jacob is still kind of like holding on and still persevering, you know, asking God for the blessing. He recognized that he needs God's blessing, and so he's not going to let go. And so I should look up again just that word for strive, and just that is a good question. Like, does it go back to the wrestling or go back to just the clinging and the holding on? It's not either of those words directly, but ultimately I think it points to the fact that he persevered and he prevailed because he did not give up.
Hey Josh?
Yeah.
Does the name have anything to do with the nation of Israel in general, or just...
What's that?
Does the meaning of Israel have something to do with the nation of Israel? Or just...
Well, I mean, it goes back to him. So, I mean, that's where the nation of Israel gets their name, is from their patriarch. But maybe I'm missing your point there. Like, basically, this is where the nation of Israel gets their name.
What's
is from
like, what's the significance of the name? Just this one event?
Yeah.
These two dudes struggle.
Right, pretty much. Yeah, pretty much. But it's such a, and I think that's where, it's such a life-changing event in the life of Jacob, I would say, where he switches from the deceiver to the prevailer, if you will. And so, to me, it signifies the difference between someone who's trying to do things his own way by deception, to now he's been transformed to the one who seeks to do things by God's way, by seeking, by not letting go of God, by, in a sense, even wrestling with God. It's all about seeking God's blessing and all about seeking God's way rather than trying to do it his own way. And that transformation in his life seems to be signified by that transformation in his name. Like, this is a life-changing event for him.
I don't want to question his motives, but it seems like it's about blessing and not, you know, it's like, I'm not going to let you go until you bless me. I don't know.
But even, I hear what you're saying, but I think the blessing is what he should have been, in this point in time, striving for. Like, that's, once again, that's what God's plan was for him, right? That's what was good in his life, is just this blessing. And once again, the you go all the way to Deuteronomy, right? What's the message? Blessing for obedience and cursing for disobedience. The blessing is what we all should be seeking, right? As we, and the application to us would be, as we are obedient to God and trusting in God, he will bless us. Not necessarily in the same kind of physical ways as we see here, but there is blessing for obedience. And so, ultimately, we of course acknowledge that most of that for us is spiritual blessing. But in that day and time, God's plan was much more related to the physical. And, you know, ultimately, even for the nation of Israel, if they were accomplishing God's plan and purpose, they would have been physically blessed to the point that they would be the exalted nation on the earth through whom God's knowledge and salvation went to the rest of the world. And so I would probably say that was something that was good for him to be seeking after. And this time, as opposed to when he was seeking the blessing to his father, he sought about it in the right way. In other words, wrestling with God and trying to seek that blessing from God, as opposed to trying to seek it by his own devices and treachery and trickery and manipulation. So, once again, it's a narrative, and so it doesn't provide all the commentary that I would like, an explanation. But without a doubt, the author is trying to make a point as he follows this narrative along. And certainly this is such a key little transitionary section as we come to this book. And then as you get to chapter 33, we're going to find out that Esau's on his side. And Esau, like, runs up and, like, gives him a big hug and a kiss, you know, and whatever. And it's ultimately because God heard Jacob's prayer. God, you know, is the one that has changed Esau's heart. And so once again, he saw it the right way, and now the whole, now there's no, like, it kind of ends on a happy note finally, right? You know, when there's been so much just like constant friction, whether it's like between he and Esau, or whether it's between he and Laban, or whether it's between his two wives, all you see is friction throughout the Jacob cycle here. But finally, there's this life-changing event, and then the rest of the story is going to be peace. You know, so you see just, and once again, this is the first time he prays. And so once again, that seems to be, this chapter seems to be the hinge in which everything changes for Jacob. And finally, he seeks the Lord, and now look at the results. All right, good stuff. We'll continue to meditate on it and think through it. But let's close in prayer. Our Father, we do just thank you for your word. We thank you for the lessons of your faithfulness and how you are trustworthy. We thank you that you keep your promises even apart from us. And we know that you will always be faithful even when we are not. But we pray that we would learn the lesson that we need to trust in you and not seek to do things from our own power and our own strength, but we would depend upon you in prayer, and that we would seek blessing from you in your way, and therefore you will work powerfully through us to accomplish your plan and purpose. And we pray these things in Christ's name. Amen.